Grateful for those two wonderful readings. Grateful for so much in this service. And grateful also that Vicar Stephen invites me to be part of the preaching team here. That's a great honour. I'm really grateful for all the encouragement he pours in to Pam and me. And by the way, we've got our guest for the weekend, Michael Bourne, Bishop Michael Bourne, sitting with us. And that's a wonderful thing. Now, as we're going to turn to the Gospel reading we had a moment ago from Matthew, and as we read this together, well, as we keep the Bible open together, Matthew 28, have a look at it, and we'll see how we get along in these next few minutes. I'm greeting you all this morning. We're still very much in the feel of Easter, with a passage that Stephen has given me to preach on, under the title of Jesus Christ the Lord. So keep that passage of Matthew 28 open with me, if you will. Matthew 28, actually we'll begin a little bit earlier than the reading we had, I think, which will put us in context, beginning with the morning of Christ's resurrection and closing with the momentous sending out of his disciples to make further disciples of every nation. Let's start with a reminder of how the morning of that stupendous third day began at verse 1, with the coming of the women to the tomb. And there we read, after the Sabbath, at dawn, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. I like that. Hey, talk about shock waves. Yes, there had been an earthquake at the time of Christ's death. Just a page back, Matthew 27, verse 51. Now, evidently, after the body of Jesus had risen and left the tomb, it was an angel from heaven that carried out the removal of the mightiest stone as this second earthquake took place. The first earthquake, as Jesus died, had been one, well, I suppose we could call it of cosmic awe, something like that. To quote that famous Jewish convert to Christ, Alfred Edersheim, he said, a shudder ran through nature. But this second earthquake was one of exultant joy, as death itself received its death blow. Now, you know, I've been in Kenya, and we used to have earthquakes sometimes there, earth tremors anyway, on the edge of the Rift Valley where we lived. When you'd see electric lights swaying above you, you'd think, what's going on? And your emotions would take over. Oh, I think of two long-standing Christian friends, Bill and Joan Brown, who were living in Hollywood during the Californian earthquake just a few years ago. They heard the car alarms outside going off. The whole house was heaving, and Joan sat up in bed and began praying fervently to God. "Don't bother with that," yelled Bill. "He's much too busy to be listening to you right now." That's what an earthquake can do to your judgment. Joan, for her part, grabbed at anything she could think of salvaging as she left the building and padded out into the road. It was only when she got outside that she realized that all she was holding on to was a tiny jar of anti-wrinkle cream. That's what can happen in an earthquake. Well, here's Matthew 28. There's an earthquake around Jerusalem as the lightning-like angel brushes aside those elaborate precautions taken by the enemies of Jesus in their vain attempt to make the tomb sealed, secure, and guarded. The guards get flattened. The tomb is opened. And the way is cleared for the coming of the women who would be the first witnesses of the Easter event. The fact is, you cannot stop Jesus. I don't think we should be puzzled too much by the little differences of reporting by the four gospel writers. It's one angel in Matthew, but two in Luke and John. Presumably, Matthew here is concentrating on the angel who was speaking. And, of course, this day of Jesus Christ the Lord, well, it was one of breathless excitement and of frantically running footsteps. It seems that one group of people would just miss another, as you sometimes find in performances on stage. It was that kind of disorientating day, indeed a bewildering day, which explains verse 8 of our passage here, where we read that the women hurried away from the tomb to tell the others. They were, it says, afraid, yet filled with joy. Something had happened. Something had happened that dramatically underlined as true everything that they had believed about Jesus. You can't stop Jesus. Oh, you can try. Plenty of people try today. Everything seemed over during the Saturday of that weekend. Jesus, the troublemaker, was dead. The tomb was sealed. The guard was posted. Christ's followers were scattered. The movement was over. And I can imagine the enemies of Jesus cheerfully watching news at 10 and going off to bed. Then, at some point on Sunday morning, bang, the guards are flattened, the tomb is open, stone is rolled back, shining angels have sat on it and converted it into a pulpit. He's not here, they tell the bewildered women in verse 6. And then there's a mild rebuke. He has risen just as he said. Till now, they've barely taken in the massive truth about Jesus that has changed our view of the universe ever since. How utterly different from a wonder worker Jesus was. Back in John 11, at the raising of Lazarus, Jesus didn't say to Martha, "I can perform miracles. Look, I can do resurrections." He never said that. He said, "I am the resurrection and the life." He's more than someone who dispenses wonderful gifts. He is the gift himself. He is the original source of life. Here was the forming of a new movement. You could call it the Fellowship of the Resurrection. "He who believes in me shall live, though he dies," said Jesus. "And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die again." The preaching in the Acts of the Apostles is just full of it everywhere. The Jesus movement began in earnest that Sunday. It doesn't look like much to begin with. It starts with the loyal remnant. That's my first observation, really. It started with the loyal remnant. Three women, to be precise. Yes, it's two women in this passage, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James. It's Mark's gospel that draws attention to a third woman, Salome. And these women, goodness me, they haven't come to anoint the body of Jesus. No, it's the second group of women who are going to come for that purpose. So all this group had come for is to look, just to be there. It's loyalty and love for Jesus that pull them to that place. Why, on that crucifixion day of Friday, they could hardly bring themselves to leave the scene as darkness closed down. It was Joseph of Arimathea, accompanied by Nicodemus, who had seen to the burial of the body in Joseph's own new tomb. And the two men then went away. Matthew 27, verse 61 tells us the women were left sitting opposite the tomb before they too had to go home. That's how Good Friday ends, ladies and gentlemen, with the two Marys. And that's how resurrection morning starts, with the two Marys. They're last at the cross, they're first at the tomb. We could say that this was the reward for their loyalty, to be the first witnesses, the first tiny instrument inserted into a solid mass of surrounding unbelief, opening up a crack in the prevailing worldview that was holding down an entire continent in the sleep of death. That little crack would be widened by other witnesses to prize open an entire world. The loyal remnant. It starts right there. Last at the cross, first at the tomb, just to be there. They weren't hoping for very much. And I say to somebody, maybe someone listening to the recording of this message, maybe a bit disillusioned with all this Christian stuff, or having doubts about the Alpha course that we just heard about, doubts about the Bible, or disappointment about the life of the church. Listen, stick around. Don't go away. Keep coming. Keep persisting. It's the faithful remnant, the people who hold on and persevere even when everything's gone sour, who will be rewarded when they happen to be on the spot when something wonderful happens in the life of the church that changes everything. Don't wait for somebody to say to you, hey, we had a wonderful time at church yesterday. You should have been there. No, let that inconspicuous little group of women be our model this day. They came for so little. They got the resurrection firsthand ahead of everybody else. Where were the other disciples? In bed asleep. The women got it. My lifelong friend, Michael Bourne here, Bishop Michael Bourne, he was my predecessor in the leading of the work at All Souls Church in London. One great Easter Sunday, we were talking about this the other day, the BBC put on a full-scale, big version of Songs of Praise for Easter. And Michael decided to invite the famous Swiss artist, Annie Valiton, to come over from the continent and illustrate the Easter message with some of the wonderful impromptu drawings that are given us such prominence in the pages of the Good News Bible. That Bible's full of her drawings. So the BBC rang her. Annie Valiton, would you be interested in coming to London on Easter Sunday and as part of the Songs of Praise to do some live drawings to illustrate the message of the resurrection? Are you interested? Annie Valiton responded with, I am not interested. I am captivated. That was a wonderful reply. That's it. That's it. Once get it about the risen Lord Jesus Christ, and we won't stay for a minute longer among those who see Easter as another church function. We shall not be interested. We shall be captivated for the rest of our days. In this passage, the world advance of Christ's resurrection message starts then with the captivation of the loyal remnant. Here's our second observation. It continues with what I call the futile resistance. I'm looking on now here, especially maybe at verse 12, as we read of the reaction of Christ's enemies. Have a look. When the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, you are to say his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble. So, we read, the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. Oh, the chief priests. We Christians today, who are indeed captivated in the wonder of the resurrected Christ, we feel like saying to those chief priests, oh, are you still there? Listen, the story's moved on. Beyond you, the message is out. The tomb's empty. Jesus has been seen, and his once distraught disciples are completely new people. The message has taken off, and here you are, left behind, fiddling around with bribes? You could have saved your money. It was a desperate act of damage limitation. Always money with the enemies of Jesus. It's true today. Here they buy his betrayal with money. Now they attempt a lying cover-up with money. You can't stop Jesus with money anywhere in the world. People tried, it won't be done. This is an example of futile resistance. Any belief system that tries to bribe people into compliance or to buy new recruits with financial and material inducements is saying, in effect, we've lost the argument. The chief priests were onto a very short-term approach. It wouldn't be long before they'd find themselves coughing in the exhaust of a new movement that had the world in its sights. This movement, are we an active part of it? It's more than a movement. It's a person. That's where the whole secret lies. If it's the very Son of God who occupies the center, then however small the beginnings, however fierce the resistance, you can't stop Jesus. It started with a loyal remnant. It continued with a futile resistance. Thirdly, it regroups with the great mandate. In the days after the resurrection, Jesus was seen on different occasions and by different people. But even now, on this very first day of his resurrection, the angel was telling those women what to do. Verse 7, go quickly and tell his disciples he has risen from the dead. He is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Moments later, the risen Christ himself confronts the women of our story. Verse 10, do not be afraid, he says. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me. So that's where verse 16 takes us to. A mountain rendezvous in Galilee. Jesus seemed to love the mountains. The Sermon on the Mount, near Capernaum. The Mount of Transfiguration. Now it's a mountain again. The scattering of the disciples is over. The rushing feet have steadied. A regrouping is taking place around the leader who is the one explanation of the church that cannot and will never die. And this in spite of the venomous attempts of governments and antichrist figures to destroy it. Around Jesus are clustered the 11 disciples. It may also be that this was the occasion referred to by the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 6, when more than 500 people, he says, were declared to be present at the same time to witness the risen Jesus. That could be so here. Verse 17 here tells us that there were some doubters, but at least they were there. They made the journey, and surely they were not going to be turned away. And in this group on the mountain, the great mandate is given. Look at the colossal claim their leader makes. Verse 18, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Well, in Jesus' earthly life, his authority was unparalleled even then over disease, leprosy, demons, guilt, death, despair. But all of that falls short of what is claimed in Matthew 28:18 here. Nothing less than the divine government of the whole universe and of the kingdom of heaven has been given, or should we say has been given back, to the risen God-man, Jesus Christ. Look at the terms of this universal mandate. Verse 19, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Jesus is here committing the ultimate and eternal welfare of the whole human race to the care not of the generals or the politicians or the dictators, but to the care by us, his friends, to make disciples. As Stephen was reminding us last week, a disciple is a follower, a learner, right through every continent. My wife Pam and I have only been members here at Christ Church since January, but how thrilled we are that our church fellowship here is no stranger to the courses put on around the world to help men and women become firm in their discipleship of Christ. We know of Alpha. That was a fine interview just now that we had about Alpha. This Christianity Explore that happens here, starting up again soon, run worldwide by my one-time colleague, Rico Tice. It's going into Arabic as its next language. And then we heard a notice this morning about that forthcoming companion course, Discipleship Explored. By God's grace, may the arrows of direction from our fellowship always be kept pointing outwards to others rather than inwards towards ourselves. And then I'm afraid that there are plenty of people today, sometimes even in church leadership, who've lost their nerve about reaching outside, about training or winning others. Some will even argue that the church should try and integrate its lifestyle with that of the unbelieving world. It was actually that very able Christian broadcaster, David Winter, who once commented that in their view, the Lord would have been quite wrong to tell Peter to be a fisherman and catch men. He should have told him to put on a frogman suit and try to identify himself with the fish. Well, that's David Winter. Of course, left to themselves as individuals, those first disciples would have been completely incompetent, useless, lost before they'd done a thing. But banded together under Christ's authority, a tide was going to roll steadily across islands and cities, whole continents, embracing indeed people of all nations. We've got some of it here. Some of you are from other nations, not here. You're here in another country. That's exactly what Jesus was wanting to happen. And then I think of what the secret behind it is. As Augustine of North Africa explained 16 centuries ago, one loving spirit, he said, sets another on fire. I wonder if that's how it happened for you. Somebody else. Somewhere along the line, there was a believing friend who made your life, and maybe my life too, my discipleship to Christ, the business of their loving care and friendship and prayers and witness. In ones and twos, this is what has happened across the whole world. This is how it's done. Some friend is there on hand. Well, it's gone worldwide. What a claim. What a mandate. And what a pledge. Surely, said Jesus, I am with you always to the very end of the age. Now, a presence is invariably superior to a memory. Supposing the Lord had said, the memory of my life and work will be with you always. No, it's stronger than that. To wake up every morning, your head coming off the pillow, and saying to yourself, another day with Jesus Christ at my side, and to be walking by his side, to be his partner in the work that we've all been given to do. He died for me. He's now my ever-living, daily risen companion, right to the end. What a claim, all authority. What a mandate, all nations. What a pledge, always. So we began with the loyal remnant, some women, in the wake of an earthquake. We continued with the futile resistance of those who wear themselves out battering at Jesus. We advance And we advance today on the strength of an unforgettable mandate given on a mountain in Galilee some 2,000 years ago, and the tide is still rolling on despite everything. If Jesus Christ hadn't risen clearly and unequivocally from the dead as the permanent conqueror of death on behalf of the whole human race, you and I would never have heard of him. The demoralized movement comprising 11 scared men would have fizzled out on the launching pad. Now, the best that might have been hoped for would be of a lingering wistfulness following the death of a local hero, the chalking up of a name over a railway bridge, Elvis lives, or something like that. And after a generation or so, the very name, like a sandcastle on the beach, would have been flattened out as successive tides washed over it. It's never been washed out. Why was it that last Sunday we were gathered here at Christ Church on Easter Sunday in a service of the Holy Communion, not to mourn Christ's death, but to celebrate it? We call it a celebration of the Holy Communion. I never heard of anybody else's death that was celebrated, but we celebrate his death because it marked the death of evil and guilt and darkness and despair. And Easter Sunday was the divine endorsement from heaven of the man of Galilee, the master of the world and holder of the keys of death and Hades. Nobody else can hold those keys. Nobody else can be entrusted with such keys. Only one. That's why, in the face of religious persecution and the death of martyrs today in country after country, nothing can actually stop Jesus. We belong to him. We're raised with him. We expect to see him one day, when he returns in power to collect us, to be with him forever. Of course, we are not interested. We are captivated.